Welcome everyone to today's Sutta class, and we're going to be looking at the Gautamukha Sutta. Which is Majjhima Nikaya 94. Gautamukha Sutta is actually a fairly slight sutta. The actual contents of it are not very substantial, nor does it have any particularly interesting correspondences and so on. So we might actually see how time goes. We might actually move on to the next sutta, the Chanki Sutta. In any case, as you can see from Sutta Central here, that the only correspondences for the Chanki Sutta in there's no Chinese correspondences, and there's just a few Sanskrit fragments. So these references here are just the volume references for the particular Sanskrit fragments, which are insubstantial. Here. And very often when we're talking about fragments, it literally means fragments. It literally means just bits of manuscripts with just a line on it or a few words, which the scholars have identified as being from the same sutta. So it's just a few lines there. But I'll just have a look at that sutta briefly. The main interest in it actually is the other point with the Gautamukha Sutta is it repeats a lot of teachings and so on which are found more commonly, more well known elsewhere. But the main interest of it is that it records what seems to be one of the later suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. So from the beginning of the sutta, so here's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation on Google Books. Thus have I heard, on one occasion Venerable Uddana was living at Benares in the Kamya Mango Grove, quite an unusual monastery. At that time the wanderer Gautamukha had arrived in Benares for some business or other. He was walking and wandering for exercise. He came to the Kamya Mango Grove. At that time Venerable Uddana was walking up and down in the open and doing walking meditation. He went up and they had some chat. And then Gautamukha said to Uddana, "Good recluse, there is no wanderer's life that accords with the Dhamma, so it seems to me here, and that may be because I have not seen such venerable ones as yourself, or because I have not seen the Dhamma here." So then Venerable Uddana stepped down from the walking meditation path, went to his dwelling, and Gautamukha went with him, and then Uddana said to him, "There are seats, Brahman, sit down if you wish." Gautamukha replies, "We did not sit down because we were waiting for Master Uddana to speak, for how could one like myself presume to sit down on a seat without first being invited to do so?" Then Brahman Gautamukha took a low seat, sat down on one side and said to Venerable Uddana, as he said before, that he didn't know whether there's any wanderer's life that accords with the Dhamma. So a typical discussion and exchange. Typical of many similar discussions between the different groups of ancient Indian wanderers and so on, and as so often the discourses are in fact a record of an interfaith dialogue, and the Brahman Gautamukha being not somebody who's dogmatically insisting on his own religion, but somebody who rather is lost and who seems to feel that questioning whether there is really a pure, perfect spiritual life or how we can find that, and even though coming within his own obviously very ancient and very rich spiritual tradition, is still feeling lost and feeling somehow that need to ask and to find out more about how it's possible to live a wanderer's life in accordance with the Dhamma. And of course you also see his humility, that he would wait for the teacher to sit down first, and that he would then voluntarily take a low seat to indicate his humility in listening to the teachings. Now this kind of exchange between a Brahmin and a Kshatriya, remember that the Buddhist Sangha, of course the Buddha himself was a Kshatriya, and the Sangha members renounced caste when they ordained in the Sangha. But nevertheless, there's this kind of the Buddhist Sangha, together with groups like the Jains and other groups of wanderers and so on tended to be associated with the Kshatriya class. And so there's this whole genre or movement of literature with discussions between the Brahmins and then the kind of new uprising religions that represented the wanderers who tended to be more affiliated with the Kshatriyas. And the interesting thing about that is that we're not surprised to find this kind of dialogue in a Buddhist scripture, which is, you know, using, you know, it has a kind of propaganda element to it of showing that the Brahmins were inferior to the Buddhists because the Brahmins didn't really know what they were doing, and the Buddhists did. But what's interesting is that these kinds of dialogues are actually recorded very frequently in the Brahmanical Upanishads as well. And it's right through the Upanishads we find again and again and again, not just one or two occasions, but similar kinds of dialogues where the Brahmins come to the Kshatriyas for teachings, or that they engage in a discussion, and eventually it's shown that the Brahmin has an inadequate knowledge of the truth, an inadequate knowledge of Brahma, and needs to be shown the truth by the Kshatriya. So it's a very interesting development and showing the very dynamic state that Indian religion was in around that time, a bit earlier than the Buddha, or like this sutta, a little bit later than the Buddha. And so also notice the opening of the sutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion Venerable Uddana was living in Benares. Of course, the vast majority of suttas start off by saying that the Buddha was living at such and such a place. And when we don't have that, and we have one of the other monks mentioned instead, that typically suggests that we're dealing with a sutta that stems from a period after the Buddha's already passed away. And this is confirmed later in the text. Okay, so then Uddana, notice how Uddana engages with the Brahmin. He doesn't sit down and just say to him, you know, our way of being wanderers is in accordance with Dhamma. What do you mean, you silly, ignorant Brahmin? But he says, listen, well, I'm going to say some things, and then if you want to agree with it, agree with it. If you think any statement of mine is to be argued against, then argue against it. If you don't understand the meaning of a statement, ask me to clarify it. Thus, how is this, Master Uddana? What's the meaning? In this way, we can discuss the matter. So it's very interesting that they're setting up the terms of the discussion before they start. Yeah? It's not a matter of a teacher telling the student what's this and what's that, but he's discussing, first of all, this is how we're going to have the discussion. And this is something that we find, I find, is told to me again and again and again by traditional Buddhists, from traditional Buddhist backgrounds, that they never have a chance to discuss or disagree with something, but they just have to sit there, and then the Dhamma is, you know, this is kind of one way Dhamma is told to them, and they never get that chance to actually engage. And just very important to notice that throughout the suttas, that this is how things are done, whether it be the monks or the Buddha or whoever, they teach by engaging and trying to bring out the truth from the other person.
Is that a formula that's repeated in
other
suttas, that
particular
one?
I think so, yeah. Certainly the style of thing is, and I think that particular passage is found elsewhere. Okay, so then when, and in the spirit of that, of course, if anyone does have any questions and so on, please interrupt at any time. So then the Uddana goes on to teach about the four kinds of persons found in the world. And now these four kinds of persons are quite a well-known group, and we've already discussed that earlier in the Kandaraka Sutta of Majjhima 51. And the four kinds of persons, the person who torments himself and pursues the practice of tormenting himself, one who torments others, one who torments both, and one who torments neither. Okay, so then the examples of these are: the one who torments himself is someone who does the practices of self-mortification, so not so rejecting food and all the various kinds of ascetic practices that we find mentioned so often in the Majjhima Nikaya, typical of the Jaina and other ascetic communities. They are sleeping on beds of nails and squatting continuously and so on and so forth. And then there's the person who torments others, which is a butcher of sheep or pigs, a trapper, a hunter, an executioner, a prison warden, a thief, or anyone who follows such bloody occupation. And interesting that a prison warden is mentioned in a list along with the thief. Both sides of the fence are equally culpable, apparently. One who torments both is described as somebody who is a head-anointed noble king or well-to-do Brahmin who builds a new sacrificial temple to the east of the city. And just to note that in those days there weren't any permanent structures in the Brahmanical religion. Right? The whole idea of Hindu temples and so on arose much later, and all the Brahmanical rituals were conducted in the open air in temporary spaces that were cleared and created for that purpose. And so having made the new ritual space east of the city, having shaved off his hair and beard, dressed himself in rough hide, greased his body with ghee and oil, and scratching his back with a deer's horn, he enters the sacrificial temple together with his chief queen and his Brahmin high priest. There he lies on the bare ground strewn with grass. The king lives on the milk in the first teat of a cow with a calf of the same colour, while the chief queen lives on the milk in the second teat, and the Brahmin lives on the milk in the third, and the milk in the fourth teat they pour into the fire as an oblation, and the calf lives on what's left. He says, thus, let so many bulls be slaughtered for sacrifice, let so many heifers and goats and so on, let so many trees be cut down. Then his slaves, messengers and servants make preparations, weeping with tearful faces, being spurred on by threats of punishment and by fear. This is the kind of person who torments himself and torments others. And then there's the one who neither torments himself nor torments others, who is here and now hungerless, extinguished and cooled, and abides experiencing bliss, having himself become holy. And this, of course, is the Buddha. And then the Brahmin Gautamukha replies, predictably enough, that the last person, the one who torments neither himself nor others, is the one who satisfies his mind, basically quoting. So notice how Dana's teaching is effectively quoting from a sutta which the Buddha taught, right, which was already circulating in the community. Now at a later date he's quoting from that, and he wants to establish the fact that, yes, it's true that there are various kinds of religious life which are unsatisfactory and don't lead to benefit, but there are also others which do, and that being the path that the Buddha taught. So then Venerable Udena goes on to talk about two kinds of assembly. What two? Here, a certain assembly lusts after jewels and earrings and seeks wives and children, men and women, slaves, fields and land, gold and silver. But a certain assembly does not lust after these things, but has gone forth from the home life into homelessness. Now there is this kind of person who does not torment himself or torture others, and abides cool and having himself become holy. In which of the two kinds of assembly do you usually see this person, Brahman? In the assembly that lusts after jewels and earrings and so on, or the assembly that has abandoned all these things? And Brahman Gautamukha replies, I usually see this kind of person, Master Udena. So we don't have this in the Google Books preview. I usually see this kind of person, Master Udena, in the assembly that does not last after material things, but in that consisting of those who have gone forth. But, and then Udena continues, but only just now, Brahman, we understood you to say, worthy recluse, there is no wanderer's life that accords with the Dhamma. And Gautamukha replies, certainly, Master Udena, it was in order to learn that I spoke these words. So in other words, he didn't necessarily believe it, but he wanted to challenge him and to try to get some. So that's always a good way to get a good Dhamma talk out of a teacher. It's something we learnt at Bodhnyana when he was staying with Ajahn Brahm. If you wanted to get a good Dhamma talk out of him, you'd wait till about 5 minutes before we were going to go off for the talk, and then you'd kind of innocently ask him a kind of a question. You'd say, I was reading this sutta the other day, Ajahn, and it really seemed to show that you don't need jhanas to get enlightened, or something like that. And then you'd be sure to get a really good Dhamma talk with that. Okay, so then he says, then Gautamukha goes on to affirm that there is a wanderer's life that accords with the Dhamma, so it seems to me here, and may Master Udena remember me to have spoken thus. It would be good if, out of compassion, Master Udena would expound to me in detail those four kinds of person he mentioned in brief, and he goes on to explain them as I've described earlier from the Kandaraka Sutta. As a result of which, Brahman Gautamukha says, magnificent, magnificent, Master Udena has made Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he was turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Udena for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. May, from today, let Master Udena remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. To which Master Venerable Udena says, do not go to me for refuge, Brahman. So notice he uses the form Master Udena, which is Bho, I think. Yeah, Bho Udena, rather than Ayasma Udena. And this being Bho being a term which is a term of address used by the Brahmins. Udena says, do not go to me for refuge, Brahman, go for refuge to that same blessed one to whom I have gone for refuge. Where is he living now? That Master Gotama, accomplished and fully enlightened, Master Udena, that blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, has attained final Nibbana, Brahman. So interesting that Udena is referring to the Buddha with the more respectful term of Bhagawa, whereas Udena, even though he's going for refuge, is still using the slightly more familiar terms of Master, Bho, both for the Buddha and for the Buddha's student, Udena. And also, I'm just sort of having a look here, but I don't think that Udena has actually mentioned the Buddha's name in the discourse so far, but even though Udena says to that blessed one, Gautamukha somehow knows that he means Master Gautama. That blessed, which is, I guess, not unexpected. He simply knows he's a well-known teacher at the time. So, and then he says, where is he living now? He's attained final Nibbana, Brahman. So this is where the sutta states that it's from the time after the Buddha passed away. And it's interesting that it says that here, parinibbuto ko Brahma etarahiso bhagava araham sama sambuddho, he's passed away. Now very often in suttas that are taught after the Buddha passed away, it says in the introductory line, it will say something like achira parinibbuto, not long after the Buddha had passed away or attained final Nibbana. So it says that in the introduction. So here it doesn't use the phrase achira, meaning not long after. So that particular phrase seems to refer to suttas for the most part, which are taught immediately after the Buddha passed away, and often even in between the Parinibbana and the First Council. Yeah? So even during the walk from Kusinara down to Rajagaha via Vesali and through Pataliputta, and there are a few suttas which seem to be told in that journey, in that period of about 3 months or so, between the Parinibbana and the First Council, and they use Achira Parinibbuto. Whereas this one doesn't use it, so presumably from sometime later, quite possibly after the First Council. Then Gotamukha says, if we heard Master Gotama was within 10 leagues, we would go 10 leagues to see him. If we heard he was within 20 leagues or 30 leagues, 40, 50 or 100 leagues, we would go 100 leagues to see him. But since he's attained to final Nibbana, we go to him for refuge and the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Now Master Udena, Gotamukha goes on, the king of Anga gives me a daily donation. Let me give Master Udena one regular donation from that. What kind of regular daily donation does the King of Anga give you? 500 gahapanas, Master Udena. So this is like something which is mentioned quite a few times, that the kings would sponsor Brahmins who presumably for a reason, and like would presume that the Brahmin would be sort of like a local governor, or you know, fulfill some kind of administrative or governmental role within his local region. So he's paid 500 gahapanas, and then Udena says it's not allowable for us to accept gold and silver, Brahman. If it's not allowable, Master Udena, I will have a monastery built for Master Udena. If you desire to have a monastery built for me, Brahman, have an assembly hall built for the Sangha at Pataliputta. I'm still more satisfied and pleased that Master Udena suggests I give a gift to the Sangha. So with this regular donation and another regular donation, I shall have an assembly hall built for the Sangha at Pataliputta. And this is what he did, and that hall is now known as the Gotamukhi. Interesting kind of process here that, you know, first of all he says, look, I don't want the money. And of course it's using the conventional phrase gold and silver, jata, rupa, rajata, the same found in the Vinaya, but of course meaning any kind of money, and here being the standard unit of coinage in that time is the kahapana. So he says, then he won't do that. He will build an assembly hall, upatthana sala, but he refuses also to have that, or he doesn't refuse, but he said he would prefer not to have that as a personal donation. Yeah? So he doesn't want to get, he doesn't want to have something built personally for him, but for the Sangha. And so, of course, the Brahmin's even more impressed by this, that not only will he not take money, he doesn't even want any buildings or anything for himself, but just something that would be of service for the Sangha. And situating it at Pataliputta, of course, was the main centre for the Sangha in the period after the Buddha passed away. And, of course, during this period, this was where the royal seat of Magadha was being shifted from Rajagaha to Pataliputta, which became Ashoka's capital. And, of course, at the end of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, we see the ministers of Rajagaha also in Pataliputta and also doing building work. So, obviously, they're building a whole new capital there, and there must have been a lot of activity, so that this was becoming the new centre, and so the Sangha needed to have its own base there and so on. So this being, making sense again to put this sutta in that period after the Buddha passed away. And the text says that sa e tarahi, that is now known as the Gautamukhi. So the whole being still in use and still well known enough at that time that the sutta was redacted. It kind of, yeah, it sounds, gives the impression that it was some period of time afterwards, yeah.
Yeah, Bodhi's got that note there that it actually wasn't called
Pataliputta
in the
Buddha's
time.
Right. Pataligama. Pataligama, yeah. Right, which is a village.
Did the Buddha give any other, did he stay at Benares?
The Buddha?
Yeah.
Yeah, from time to time. Yeah, no, just not all that often, but from time to time, yeah. Why is that nice?
Well, there's the another place adventure.
Well, yeah, well, that was where the first sermon was, of course.
Yeah,
but there's various places, various times when he went back there. Any questions about that? It was when I was doing it, I just had a bit of a double take because he said he's sponsored by the king of Anga, which is kind of interesting because he's in Benares, which is here, Kasi.
Yes.
So it's quite a long way from Anga. And then he's building, and Magadha is in between.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's time Magadha and Pataliputta is in the middle, so it's kind of interesting, he must have been travelling over there. But it also seems to reflect the time when Anga was still an independent kingdom, which of course it got swallowed up by Magadha sometime not too distant, not long after that. Also should probably remark, just to come back to the main theme of it, is that one of the basic themes is the often cruelty of the Vedic sacrifices, and of course it's something you still see today, many animals being slaughtered and so on at that time. And of course this became a major theological issue within the Brahmanical religion, because in the old, see that the Vedas stem from an old time of hunting and war and all of these kinds of things, so the ideas of non-violence and that weren't really found in the ancient Vedas at all. They were warriors. Yeah, they were out there with their chariots and their horses, and calling on their thunder gods and Indra and smite these people down. And let's go in and so it's a pretty kind of energetic religion, and which sort of reflecting their position. Religion of the Vedas is actually I find it very beautiful in many ways. It's the religion of the Vedas is a very kind of refreshingly untormented religion. You know, they were really kind of confident about what they were doing. It's kind of got this young spirit, you know, it's got this young masculine spirit. Here we are, we're going to go and we're going to conquer, and yay, all the gods are on our side, and aren't the gods good? They're giving us all this bounty, and all the goddesses are giving their rain, and everything is happy, and it's a very kind of positive spirit, but it's not kind of very reflective, and there's not a lot of ideas like compassion and so on in there. And they sort of, as they gradually came out through the course of Indian history, perhaps people got a bit more cynical, they'd experienced a bit more loss, sort of the cycles of the civilizations and so on, and a bit more experience of suffering and so on, and these ideas gradually began to come in to the Buddhist, or to the Indian religious sphere. And so the Brahmins kind of had to struggle with these ideas, and especially, you know, how can we justify doing these, you know, sacrifices where so many animals are killed and all of these kinds of things, in when at the same time we're learning about the values of non-violence. And the Brahmanical or the Hindu tradition has come to many different solutions of that. And of course the Hindu tradition is so complex and so on, it's not a unified religion in a normal sense. So everyone comes to a different conclusion. Sometimes they say, well, you know, you shouldn't kill animals except it's okay in the Vedic sacrifices because the gods said it was all right. But, you know, different ones will come to different conclusions about that. Others will say, well, look, the sacrifices belong in the past and these days we shouldn't be doing them and so on. Whereas, of course, the Shramana religions, Buddhism and Jainism and others, just rejected the sacrifices out of hand. And one thing to notice about the sacrifice, which often we don't recognize, and which is not necessarily, even in the criticisms, Buddhist criticisms in the Buddhist texts of the sacrifices, that they don't, the sacrifices have a very significant economic role in redistributing wealth. Yeah? And I think, as Aya was saying, that sacrifices, you were seeing it in the Kali in Calcutta, that the priests were saying, well, look, all the slaughtered meat goes to the poor people, and you know, and this is actually what would happen often. It's not necessarily cynical or anything, but this is what would happen. It actually forms a major part of how protein and nutrition and so on actually gets redistributed from the wealthy to the poor, that they could actually take part in these sacrifices. And you know, many of the poor people around the world don't get to eat protein food, rich nutritious protein food, very often. And so this would be a rare occasion when they would do that. And it would also be a means that would stop the wealthy from accumulating too much and from getting too distant from the people and so on. So that even though obviously there's always cruelty involved, but within the culture and the economic climate, the sacrifice can have a positive role. All right. Any more questions on that one? So do you think we should move on to the Chanki Sutta? Yeah.